Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hi folks, welcome to the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters, episode 84, Clive of India. I am joined by Bo, and we are going to be talking about yet another eccentric English adventurer who did marvellous things, reinforcing our great man of history theory support. So, Clive, just born in like Somerset or something, wasn't he?
Oh gosh, where was he born? Yeah, it was in southern England somewhere, like Shropshire or something?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
To like minor gentry, of no account.
Yeah, he wasn't a complete peasant, but he was very minor, very, very minor gentry.
So no one liked him. Even he was getting, you know, looked down the nose upon.
Yeah, in his school days, apparently he was a little bit naughty.
Yeah.
Well, first thing to say that you mentioned is the great man of history thing. So people who might not know, most people who are watching this do know all about this debate. But some views of history are that the single great men that sway all of history, or can do sometimes, and other people say, usually Marxists say, that no such thing is possible, that does not exist. History is all about, ideas, and the individual people don't matter so much.
It's a dialectic.
Right, exactly, but there's a few people in history where it's crazy to deny it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar.
And as I understand, Clive is kind of one of these people.
Well, because what he did and what he decided to do swayed events.
So. As I understand it, there's he did some great things in India. He goes back to England. Things start falling apart in India and they all just look to Clive and go, well, you're going to have to go back and sort that out. It's like, well, if it's not dependent on the great man, why does it have to be him? Why don't you just send anyone? Don't you have other men in India that can do things? No, apparently. So, this is why I think the great man of history has got a lot more legs than people give it credit for, than the communists give it credit for.
Yeah, and I also think that you don't have to necessarily be like an individual great man like Augustus.
No.
Or like the first emperor of China or something, but just individual leaders, what they decide really matters. For example, one tiny example, when David Cameron decided he was going to have a referendum. Okay, that changed history. And most of his party, most of the people around him say, don't do that, don't do that.
That's a crazy idea.
But he decided that's what he was going to do.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But like I was saying the other day when I was doing a live stream with some friends, the great man is someone who has to encounter a certain sort of substratum of events to be able to then tie it all together and make the decision to go in a particular direction. You know, he can't just raise Atlantis out of the ocean or something. You know, he has to find it there to be able to do it. But once it's there, once you've got the necessary requirements, how he acts is totally up to him, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a couple of points here. I mean, Napoleon's a great example of it as well. What he decides on an individual day, on an individual moment, to give a green light on something or not.
Yeah.
That history turns on that moment. And Clive's one of those people where he decides to or not do something. It influences millions and millions of people at the time, and you could argue now the echoes of it affect billions of people.
I think you could.
Yeah. So Robert Clive.
Yeah.
It wasn't landed, didn't have a title or anything. They were sort of fairly firmly middle class. He went to a effectively what would have been like a grammar school.
Yeah.
So he's 18th quite well educated. Yeah, he was reasonably well educated. he didn't go to Eton or anything, but could read and write certainly, and all that sort of thing. It seems he spoke well. But later in life, we realise that the sort of high snobbery of the upper gentry never accepted him.
Well, yeah.
But we'll get into all of that. His childhood's fairly uneventful. All that really matters is that he was a little bit naughty. There are some stories because some people. That sort of hate Robert Clive or hate what he did, people with a chip on their shoulder.
Yeah, Mughal emperor sympathisers.
They've tried to, there's various stories where they tried to say he was like a really bad kid. He was like violent and stuff, but there's just no evidence for that, it seems.
As I understand, he was often sick, right?
He was a bit sickly.
Yeah.
A little bit sickly.
Yeah, so he's kind of weak kid, bit naughty. Don't expect that much from him.
Yeah. But it seems that like a lot of young men, he was quite restless, you could say. He, you know, wouldn't necessarily just, wasn't really built for a desk job.
Mm.
Although having said that, his first role was as some sort of clerk for the East India Company. So when he's about 17 years old in 1744, his family decide, especially if you haven't got a lot of money, the kids have to go off and do something quite quickly. Certainly by the time you're 17, that's kind of old, really,
yeah,
compared to like real poor families.
Age.
Yeah. So they decide to send him, that he should join the East India Company.
Mm-hmm.
And the East India Company at that point wasn't sort of this, it'd already been around for like ages, 150 years or something. Yeah, about 150 years. It was founded in sort of 1600 under Queen Elizabeth. But even by 1744, it wasn't sort of this giant world-spanning behemoth. Well, it was world-spanning, but it wasn't this giant thing that dominated whole countries.
It wasn't a juggernaut.
Yeah, it wasn't a juggernaut yet. It was rich and powerful, but it was
but
still...
But it was a company that traded.
Exactly. Yeah. It was about trading. It was about making money or dividends for the shareholders. That's what it was about. And they had some men under arms. There was an armed force, but it wasn't like this giant thing that swayed whole countries yet. That sort of happens under Clive. So when he's 17, they decide they'll send him out to India under the East India Company as a clerk. It's like I say, sort of middle class. Yeah. So he could have that sort of job. And in those days, it took, it took about a year and 2 months to get out there. It's
That's
very
hard
slow.
To even imagine, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's very slow.
It's going to take you, you're off now, Clive. Where am I going? India? Well, Christ, well, how long is that? You're going to be nearly 19 by the time you get there.
Mm, yeah.
It's a year on a ship.
Yeah. So to go to India or go to the East Indies and back again could be 3 or 4 year round trip.
Yeah.
Assuming you didn't spend all that long out there.
Yeah, and people did it all the time. It's crazy.
Right. And it's very, very difficult. You have to be, you could easily be killed in a shipwreck.
Yeah.
And if conditions on the ship become, you know, too unsanitary and some sort of disease rips through the ship, sometimes it's a real like a hellacious experience.
Mm. Or pirates and privateers, the French fleets. Who knows what could happen to you?
Yeah.
You know, it's fraught with danger.
So he goes out to Madras, but there's another point you've just hit on there. There is an on and off hot and cold war between the English and the French in the whole world.
Yeah. In every theatre of war.
Yeah.
In every theatre of the world.
It's on and off hot war and constantly a cold war between them. And so even at this point, there's sort of the Second Carnatic War, which is basically somewhere between a hot and a cold war in India between the French and the English.
Mm.
And we are really the English still, not the British, exactly, at this point.
Well, 1707.
There has been the Union of the Crowns.
Yeah.
But quite often in the accounts, it speaks of English arms and the English army.
Yeah.
Just to mention that, the East India Company, very few Englishmen or Britishmen, quite often there was officers and men from all over the place.
Really?
Yeah, from everywhere. From Germany, from Portugal, from Denmark.
They
could be from anywhere.
That was founded when it was just England, wasn't it?
That's it. A bit later, it's always firmly the British Empire, the British army, but at this point, quite often still, they just talk about the English.
Mm.
The French quite often refer to us as just the English.
Mm.
The English have done this or that in India.
Yeah.
But quite often it could be, the officers especially, could be from anywhere in Europe. Clive and his directors in the East India Company just talk about European soldiers, European officers.
Yeah, I saw that.
As long as they're European, that's sort of the main thing.
Yeah. Well, I imagine what they're talking about is a certain level of technological expertise, right? As in they can stand in ranks and form like firing lines and reload rifles and things like this, which of course, you know, many natives wouldn't be able to do because of course they've not had any training to do it.
Yeah, quite a lot of the East India Company in this period, and later, the East India Company soldiers are what they called sepoys, native Indian soldiers.
Mm.
And sometimes they were very, very good at the Battle of Assaye. The Indian sepoys were amazingly good, pretty much as good as the Scots Guards.
Right.
But often, especially in earlier periods, you couldn't rely on them not to run away in the face of an enemy bombardment.
Right.
Whereas the European soldiers or the British soldiers would just stand there and take it nearly always.
It?
Yeah, mad. Absolutely mad.
Hey, that's how we defeated Napoleon, so you know.
Right, yeah. Okay, so he goes out there, and the East India Company sort of had three main centres of control, but they're all very small.
Yeah.
Fort St. William in Calcutta, little place in Bombay, and down in Madras. Madras is much more on the southeast side of India, in the Bay of Bengal. And there was a little Fort St. George that was there. Tiny little things, really. Even by this point, you know, not many years before the whole picture changes, the East India Company and British interests in India was tiny little pockets on the coast.
Yeah.
No more than that.
And there lots of other trading posts from other nations, right? The Dutch, the French, Portuguese probably, you know, like had their own, like, so it was all sort of up for grabs, basically, wasn't it?
Yeah. So there's the British East India Company, but the Danish had a version, the Swedish had a version, the Portuguese had a version, the Dutch East India, and the French, of course, are out there.
Yeah.
So there's quite a few European nations that are doing more or less the same thing.
I just love that we travel halfway across the world, and what are we doing? We're fighting against the French. Like, really? Really? It took a year to get here, and there's a Frenchman over there. And now I'm at war with him. Of course there is. Yeah. Like bloody cockroaches.
Yeah. And it's it's all about trade and money. Yeah. It's not about territory or empire building yet.
Yeah.
It's just about money. And the main one was textiles. Mm-hmm. You could get super good quality, super cheap textiles from India. That changes over time. But originally, these various East India companies or East Indies companies would go out to what is now places like Indonesia for spices. That's how it all began. And then they realised, oh, actually, we can get great textiles from India. We can get great porcelain from China. Mm. And it spread out from there. But originally, it was all about spices, really. The Spice Islands, the East Indies. And that's a little bit of an early period. But so here we've got this Fort St. George around Madras, and the French are probably, well, they are the most powerful European nation in southern India at that point.
Yeah.
They've got the Marquis Dupleix is the sort of their leader out there. Mm. And the French basically think, well, you know, if we can, just realpolitik, if we can defeat the English here, we could probably get a monopoly on all of India.
Just love the way the Indians must have been like, okay, these weird foreigners have turned up. What's happened? They're fighting each other. They've brought this ancient enmity. I mean, it's much like the Indians and Pakistanis fighting in Leicester, isn't it? Like, what are you doing? Yeah. You know, go. Why are you fighting here?
Yeah. Just because we're on the other side of the world doesn't mean we don't still hate each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly the same sort of dynamic playing out in Leicester. Yeah. Except the French and the British were the same religion, at least.
But anyway.
The East India Company, one of the lines is that they're
raising... I'd probably disagree with that. You know, I actually agree with David Starkey that England's religion is England. I think that's a good way of taking on it.
But in the sort of mid-18th century, they were sort of fairly firmly
obviously we're
Anglican.
Christian.
Yeah. But the East India Company's... Their modus operandi, their raison d'etre is, quote, to establish a policy of civil and military power to secure material profits. Mm-hmm. So that's what it was. It wasn't necessarily just to conquer as much territory as possible for the crown.
No.
That's a different thing. That's later.
That was a consequence of the success of the company, wasn't it? You know, wasn't it Clive who recommended that the crown take over the company as well?
Exactly.
Because this is a thing that is hard to explain about the British Empire and how it's different to, say, the Roman Empire, is it wasn't just about territorial acquisition. In fact, most of it was sort of, you know, private companies, chartered by the crown, but off doing things. I mean, another interesting point is the British crown restrained the American colonists from going westward into the interior of the continental Americas. And it's like, well, why would you do that if you were this, you know, world-spanning empire? It's actually, they were trying to balance books back in London. You know, they were like, no, that's an expensive acquisition. We don't want that. You know, and it's just very interesting how, like, there's this natural tendency to not expand from central government. But the society itself is very expansive and is taking over things because it can.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If your ultimate goal is to make money, then quite often expansion is not a good idea.
No.
Because it's going to cost you more money. Or it's going to be more dangerous.
Yeah. We need more soldiers to guard that fort, to guard these trade routes, to make sure that these aren't predated on by pirates or, you know, rival enemy factions or whatever. And it's just like, this is a headache. It's a giant headache. We were making lots of money. We don't need this.
And war can be really expensive.
Yeah, incredibly expensive.
Slightly after this period, when the East India Company does sort of become a de facto empire of its own, people, like the directors and the shareholders of the company, aren't necessarily all that happy. They're more worried because it's not. They have to spend lots and lots of their profits on soldiery.
Yeah, I mean, what war for the East India Company is just burning money. You're setting fire to money and burning it in a big pile.
And really, their policy is largely just whatever we need to do to keep the peace.
Yeah.
No, we don't want to expand into Sindh or somewhere. Yeah. No, whatever we need to do, it's ruining our bottom line. Yeah. Stop having wars. Yeah, that's what they're like.
Yeah, that's a massive debt that's going on the balance sheet. We don't want that. That's not good.
Yeah. Well, so at different periods, their sort of policy, their thinking is a bit different. And we'll get into it. It's a big sea change during the career of Clive of India. Mm. Just a big sea change.
I love the idea that the East India Company is just saddled with this amazing general and he just keeps winning stuff. And that's like, please stop. You know, we just want to trade spices.
We just want to trade spices, bro. There's a great line. I was going to leave it to the end.
Giga Chad Clive just can't help himself.
There's a super great line from Sir Winston Churchill. I was going to leave it till the end. I thought it was a great line to finish it on. But as we've been talking about this, I think I'll say it now. Yeah. Churchill said that, quote, "Of India, it has been well said that the British Empire was acquired in a fit of absent mind."
Absence of mind,
Absence of mind, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, in the same way that the Roman Empire was conquered in self-defense, ours was just accidental.
Mm.
Didn't even mean to. So suddenly we're controlling, like, you know, a third of the globe or something. So
quick word then to say about India and the sort of the Muslim Mughal empire in India.
Yeah, a foreign empire occupying India.
So first of all to say, we're used to a map where there's this giant country called India.
Yeah.
That's just not what was the case in the 18th century.
It's a subcontinent.
Yeah, it was broken up and had been for a long time into all sorts of different bits.
Mm.
It wasn't just this one country called India.
No.
You had like the Muslim Mughals who come from largely Persia, modern sort of Iran and places like that.
Who claimed descent from the Mongols.
Yeah, they were descendants of Tamerlane and Genghis Khan ultimately, places like that. You had the Marathas. A completely different people to the Mughals in India. You had giant swathes of it were controlled by basically Afghan people in eastern India. Yep. There was the place called Sindh, which is sort of the Indus Valley, were like their own thing. The Deccan plains were controlled, like the kings of Mysore, controls of Mysore, more in sort of central, more southern India. And on and on and on. Different pockets of completely different peoples.
Mm.
Mostly not native Hindu Indians, nearly always.
Yes.
So to throw into that the French and the English and the Dutch.
But the reason I think that's important is because the British are often characterized as if they are a uniquely foreign imperial venture over India, which is actually like, no, we weren't uniquely foreign. We came to India as traders and found foreign empires already ruling over large parts of India. And in the contest between various empires, again, we weren't even trying to take it over, really. That wasn't the initial plan. And in the contest between empires, we happened to come out victorious. So the other foreign empires lost. And so, like, the left-wing habit is to characterize the Mughals as, like, the legitimate indigenous emperors of India, and it's like, no, they weren't.
Yeah,
you lunatics, that's just nonsense. You know, it's the poor indigenous Mughals. It's like, no,
yeah,
no, they're as indigenous as we were.
Yeah, they're largely hated by the sort of the truly indigenous Hindus of India,
because the Muslim, I mean, it was genuinely a genocidal, like, just cavalcade for hundreds of years into India. And I saw an article the other day that were estimated something like 400 million Indians were slain over like a 500-year period because of the just continual Muslim invasions. Because the Muslims looked at the Indians with absolute horror because the Indians were idol-worshipping polytheists, which is precisely what Muhammad was like, no, that's strictly forbidden. These people are evil. And so when they get to India, they're like, oh my God. These people literally worship idols. This is, I mean, you know, at least the Christians and the Jews, okay, fair enough, They're wrong, you know, but they're not evil.
They are people of the book.
Exactly. They're not evil. They worship the same God as we do. These people have dozens of gods. They're thousands of gods. You know, these, no, this can't stand. I'm going to get my saber, you know, it's or scimitar, you know, it's like, yeah, anyway, that's basically summarizes the Muslim attitude to discovering India.
Yeah. The Muslim moguls, were extremely harsh to the native Indians. I mean, like the way, Muslim rulers nearly always treat their subject peoples, the kafir, with disdain and brutality.
I mean,
nearly always.
Like the left wing charge against the British is that it was a racist empire. It's like, well, so were the Muslim empires, but religionist. You know, that's kind of how they were. You know, you had to pay a tithe just for being a different religion. It's like, okay, well, how's that different to paying a tithe just for being a different race? You know.
Mm.
You're still categorizing a sub, you know, the majority of people as being inferior, and you are a superior privileged caste. So, you know, characterize it how you like.
Yeah, yeah. Even in a sort of a generation or two after this, when Sir Arthur Wellesley is in India, and they're still overthrowing sort of the last remnants of Muslim kings, Nawabs, in India, in Mysore, like the second or third Mysore War, they still speak Persian.
Yeah,
and things. There's like this, there's this basically Persian Muslim overclass over the Indians there.
Yeah.
Well,
just to make it clear that India isn't like a homogenous nation state that we've just turned up and, you know, brutalized. No, they were under occupation already.
Yeah. Yeah. And had been for hundreds and hundreds of years. Yeah. The Mughals have been there for a few hundred years.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the Taj Mahal. That's an Islamic thing.
Yeah. And before then you had other Islamic empires that had ruled like large swathes of like the northwestern India, and then you did have some, like, you know, native empires and things, but it was just, it wasn't a homogenous united land, is what I'm saying.
No, far from it.
No,
absolutely far from it. The modern idea of India is just that, fairly modern
and probably quite artificial.
It's a united thing.
I mean, if what we're seeing in India with Modi at the moment is anything to go by, it seems like it's artificial. You know,
right?
It doesn't seem like it's a united. You know, but anyway, doesn't matter for our purposes.
When you have massive countries like that, like China, and there's different ethnicities within it, you have to sort of hold it together in sort of a fairly artificial way.
Hmm.
but anyway, let's go back to the Cold Wars, the Carnatic Wars between the French and the English out there.
Yeah. So 10,000 miles away, the English and the French were at war.
The Marquis Duplex said of the English, "Some may say the English are bound by treaties like us. This is a mistake. Nothing binds the English except force."
We currently pay France £50 million a year to stop dinghies coming across.
Yeah. That quote is just unfair and wrong. It's not really correct.
I'm not saying that we don't break treaties. I'm just saying you guys don't keep treaties.
Right. I mean,
you know, you can call us perfidious Albion if you want, but that's £50 million a year for Frenchies. Right, okay. But nothing binds the English except force. Well, that goes for everyone, doesn't it?
Mm.
Come on.
Down in south eastern India, the French had their big base at Pondicherry. Mm. That's classically for generations. That was just synonymous with the French presence in India, Pondicherry. Mm-hmm. Pondicherry. And that's really kind of near Madras. It's down in the same region anyway.
Mm.
So they decide to attack Madras. This is when once Clive, the very, very young Clive, sort of 18, 19, 20 years old, they attack and, in fact, are successful. And
remarkable.
Yeah.
Must have caught us unawares.
Yeah, well exactly, yeah. Clive is taken prisoner as a civilian prisoner, because at this point he's just like a clerk, sort of clerk.
18, 19, he's just a kid.
Mm. But he shows sort of an early streak of the sort of the man he is, the character he is, by disguising himself and slipping through the French lines.
Doesn't he go in like blackface or something?
There's a suggestion that he darkens his face.
So now he's cancelled.
Right, yeah. Yeah, definitely ripped down his statue.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
Man did blackface once to escape the French. Can't have that.
But that takes sort of, you know, panache, doesn't it, to do something like that?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting in sort of World War II, for example, when officers are like, well, there's no question whether I'm going to keep trying to escape. Of course I am.
Hmm.
Of course. A lot of people just resign to their fate, aren't they?
Yeah.
And some people just will not have it.
Yeah.
Anyway, Clive seems to be one of those. He escapes back to English Lions,
mm-hmm.
Back to Fort St. George, I believe. He's supposed to have said at this point, or did, write back saying it was homesick. Wrote, "When I think of my dear native England, it affects me in a very particular manner."
This is something that you get from a lot of English explorers and travellers. That you just, I mean, I'm reading that Henry Morton, halfway through Henry Morton's In Search of England. And it's just like he says exactly the same thing. There's this profound longing for just the rolling hills of England. And it's something you get a lot, actually.
Yeah.
And I'm reading Hitchens' Abolition of Britain as well, and he was quoting someone else, I can't remember who it was, talking about the English character, and it's just like they've got this weird attachment to their little damp island. It's like, yeah, well, it's ours.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Green and pleasant land.
Yeah.
I've been on holiday, obviously, loads of times in my life, but only two or three times have I been away for sort of months on end. Mm. And every time, yeah, I sort of got a bit homesick.
Oh, yeah.
One time I went backpacking around Southeast Asia, and by the end of it, I was like, I can't wait to get back to damp old England. Yeah. I just can't wait.
I had this. The first time I went on a proper foreign holiday was to Tenerife when I was 14 with my parents. And it was, interesting. We were there for 2 weeks. But I was genuinely emotional flying back over and seeing the rolling hills of England. Mm. I was genuinely emotional. I didn't even know why. I was just like, genuine tear in my eye. I was like, oh, my God, thank God I'm back.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now I feel the same.
Yeah.
Actually, when he escaped, he went back to a slightly different place, Fort St. David.
Right.
But these are sort of classic names, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, these are great.
Now, at that point, he decided that he would join the military wing of the East India Company.
Mm.
He decided that would be the best thing to do for him. He wrote, I was of the opinion that acting in a military sphere was the most honourable of the choices open to me and the most conducive to the company's service.
Yeah.
Very 18th century.
That is very 18th century. But also, it goes to show you what he is interested in. This is exciting, and he wants some excitement.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. There was only like 200-odd men at Fort St. David.
Yeah.
That's another thing to mention. In all these things, the numbers are tiny compared to different points in history.
Oh, gotcha. 200
really
men
tiny.
Is nothing.
A few hundred guys here or there. A couple of thousand guys sometimes here or there.
You can see why the Mughals weren't particularly concerned about these tiny European outposts taking over.
Mm.
Well, why would it? There's 200 guys, and then what are they going to do? You know? I've got 40,000 men under arms. What are they going to do? They haven't got enough ammunition to shoot all of my men.
Oh, something to say real quick that I meant to say when we first started to talk about the Mughals is that even though they've been in India for a few hundred years, in the broad sweep of history, they're sort of the rot are set in.
Yeah.
And they're
the sick man of India.
Right. Yeah. Their various empires, the various Nawabs, sort of Mughal kings and Nawab.
Mm.
They're independent and they've broken up and they're not sort of, they're not in the ascendancy, shall we say. And so they're on the downward curve of their civilization.
Decadence has set in at this point.
Right. Yeah. Mm. People said that India, historians have said like India can be like a temptress.
Mm.
You can quite easily just relax. It's easier just to relax.
I bet it is.
And just be...
It's the Capua of Asia.
To be self-indulgent, right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so apparently...
It's a really rich place. There's a, very nice climate, lots... And the people aren't very warlike, I think is a good way to put it. Because this is one of the things that I think the Hindus really suffered from. I watched a documentary about this the other day, and they were just talking about the Muslim invasions. And the problem with Hinduism is it's not a warlike religion. The problem. It's not a problem for a civilized people, but when you've got a warlike people like Muslims coming in, well, that makes things a bit difficult for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's true. There's different religions. Like Buddhism doesn't really lend itself to conquest and war.
No.
Of course, sometimes you do get sort of militant Buddhist monks.
Mm.
It does happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's a military aspect to Hinduism, but it's not
in general.
It's it's not like Islam,
right? Where it is all about you venerate a warlord.
Yeah, Muhammad was a conqueror. Right. And I'm not even saying that's dishonorable. I actually find that kind of respectable. But admit what you are.
Yeah, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Apparently, amongst the East India Company soldiers at this time, it was very, very lax. It wasn't disciplined. They're not the king's men.
Yeah.
You're not sort of particularly well drilled. You're not sort of massively well drilled or anything. Mm. So, and Clive sort of tries to turn that around straight away as soon as he really joins.
Sorry, we're 10,000 miles from home and there are only 200 of us. I think we're going to have to shape up here a bit, lads.
Mm.
Especially if we're at war with the French. They've already taken Fort St. George.
It could make all the difference. Yeah. A little bit of discipline.
Oh, gotcha. Well, we know it does. I mean, Christ.
Yeah.
That's why the British did any good anywhere, to be honest. It's just extreme amounts of discipline.
One last story I'd like to say from his very early life, just an anecdote really, but it gives sort of the measure of the man, is that apparently he was playing cards with some basically card sharks down there, and he caught them cheating and called them out on it. And the other guy pulled a pistol out and put it to Clive's head and said, like, you better not call me a cheater, or like, take that back or whatever. And Clive was supposed to have said, no. No, you are...
I caught you cheating.
Yeah, you are a cheater. You're supposed to have said, fire and be damned.
Oof, like this. I like the cut of this guy's gym.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the other guy backed down. He basically, essentially went, oh, okay. Like, all right, and slinked off, essentially.
Good for him.
But again, there's certain men that just, they've got a line in the sand, even if it's just a rhetorical one, even if it's just over words. We were talking about Doc Holliday. There's a line in the sand.
Yeah.
And if you cross it, well, it's a matter of life and death now. Yes, I will die. This is the hill I'm going to die on right now, over almost nothing.
Yeah,
it's the line in the sand for me.
I like that kind of hard-headedness, you know.
Mm.
But you get these kind of guys who just enjoy the risk, you know. They'll create risk around them. They need to live for it. And Clive's obviously one of these guys.
And it sort of doesn't matter what the odds are, even if it's really overwhelming odds. There's a guy with a gun to your temple when you're unarmed. So there are no real odds. Everything is stacked against you, right? You've got, and yet that's it. A line has been crossed in the sand, so I'm not going to back down.
Force of personality.
Yeah, it's rare these days. Very rare.
It is.
It seems like more people were like that in the past.
We have more examples of it from the past. Right. Like very few people these days seem to have a line in the sand, but this is just the curse of modernity.
Mm.
You know, because I mean, notice how when he's like, oh, I'm going to join the army, the military wing of the East India Company, because it's most honourable. Well, who cares about honour? You know, but if you're men who do care about honour, well, unsurprisingly, you get more people like this.
Mm. Yeah, and he really does care about honour. Towards the end of his life, it will become entirely clear that he cares more about that than fortune or money or anything.
Very based.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.